Welcome back. It's Audio Open Lines. Haven't gotten to any audio because the question we've laid on the table has been pretty fruitful in terms of your caller's response. The men are starting to chime in on the issue of contraception. We talked earlier in the first hour with Alan Carlson about contraception in Protestant history. It is probably a surprise to many Protestants that the attitude and the position on contraception has not always been laissez-faire as it is now. In fact, if you count Luther and Calvin as representative of the Protestant movement, both of them were pretty clear that contraception was against the Word of God. What about you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Chantry's still on the line. He's already answered the question whether he considers contraception to have been good or bad for society. He said the fruit has not been good. Why don't you pick up where you left off, Chantry?
Okay. I don't know. I'd let you answer or cover more of what that fruit is. I mean, I would basically say it's, again, what one of the ladies had said earlier, you know, people having the idea that they can have free sex, you know, anytime, where they want it. Following up with that, contraception in terms of, I think somebody also mentioned, like, the rhythm method or whatever. You know, I would say that there probably is very little or nothing wrong with it because, for one thing, it takes two people knowing each other. You know, you can't practice the rhythm method with somebody that you don't know or that you're just shacking up with for the weekend or something. And so in that way, you know, if you're not comfortable having many children or whatever, then following the rhythm method as best you can, but knowing that, you know, sex does lead to children, so also be aware that if you do still get pregnant, it's still your child, and you know, you need to love it and care for it and raise them in the faith. So that's the main part of it. The other thing is I had said at the beginning that my wife and I, we have two sons and apparently don't have any trouble having children, but we're also thinking about adoption. And, you know, that's an interesting part of it now that, I mean, we could probably very well have all of our own children, you know, as many of our own children as we wanted, but we would also like to adopt as well. So, you know, what your thoughts might be about that, you know.
Thank you very much, Chantry. Now, he raises another question, and that is, there are a lot of children out there, wanted children, who are sitting around waiting for adoption. And when I say out there, I mean everywhere, not just in the United States, but especially overseas. And someone could make the argument, it kind of sounds like a quaint argument from the 70s, you know, and I don't want to sound too crass here, so just bear with me. Why bring another child into this world when there are so many who do not have parents? So maybe our responsibility is not to simply have as many children as we can have, but to start parenting the ones that don't have parents in this world. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I think adoption is always a good idea. It's always a good idea. It's always preferable to, interminable foster care or living in an orphanage. Lois calls from St. Louis. Hi, Lois.
Good afternoon, Todd. I just wanted to say that I believe that since Christ died, that now that we're under grace, that God does give us the privilege of planning our families and having the number of children we would like to have. I don't know if that's really the case or not, or if I'm just trying to make myself feel good because I haven't had as many children as I could have had. Another thing that I would like to say is that for every child that is not conceived and born, it's one less child that will have the opportunity to come to know that Jesus Christ loved them and died for their sins, too. So that kind of gives me pause for examining my own heart, my own motives, because I was selfish and only wanted to have as many as I felt like I could handle sanely. But that's just pretty much all I wanted to say.
All right, Norma, thank you very much. She's being very honest to say, look, this is... Um, were my motives pure in having the number of kids we've had or in not having more children? None of us can say we have acted out of pure motives. See, let me put it this way. If you say, look, contraception is wrong, and so you don't practice contraception, and then you think, now we're having sin-free sex because we're open to the possibility of children at any time. You're wrong. You know, your motivation even for not practicing contraception is never pure either. Let's see. DB calls from his car. Hi, DB.
Hey, Todd. This question has really been on my mind the last few years. When my wife and I were first married 7 years ago, at that time I wasn't sure how many children I wanted to have, and then eventually got to the point I wasn't sure I wanted to have children at all. And finally, when I felt like it was a good time for us to start having children, we began to quote-unquote try, and that's when we discovered that we were infertile. And we discovered we probably would never be able to have biological children. And I realized how quickly God showed me that things weren't really as under my control as I like to think. And so we began to pursue adoption. And last year, we were selected by a birth mother to adopt a child. And we went through 6 months of, spent bluntly, legal hell getting this child. After we had seen him just a few minutes after he was born, we spent about a week with him and then weren't able to see him again for 6 months. And I realized during that time how precious having a child was and what a blessing it was, and really desiring God to give us that child. And he finally did. But it made me realize how selfish my motivations had been to decide to control my own life and try to decide how many children we were going to have and that kind of thing. And it was funny, about 2 months after, so I finally got settled into this, thinking, well, now this is how God will operate. We'll adopt other children, and we'll have that kind of control over our lives. I'll decide when it's time to adopt and those kinds of things. And 2 months later, my wife was pregnant. And so she's just 3 months pregnant now, and I realized I have no control over anything. And really, it's always up to God's sovereignty and his providence what he does.
DB, thank you very much. Right, and God has his ways of, he gets his thing done. Someone I think it was Lois who was on the line, who I mixed up with Norma. Sorry about mixing up the names. Lois on the line before said, it's a couple callers, and I think even Jeff mentioned this earlier. You know, how many kids were we supposed to have? But there's no way for us to answer that question. So don't lose sleep over how many kids were we supposed to have? Were you supposed to have more? You can't tell. God doesn't reveal these things to us, and he doesn't want us losing sleep trying to answer questions he doesn't give answers to. Well, we had three. It must have been God's will for us to have three. Not necessarily. Even when everything's said and done, we don't step back and say, well, it must have been God's will because it happened that way. No, there are lots of things in this world that happen that way, and they're certainly not God's will. So we leave those questions. How many were we supposed to have? Did we have too few? We leave those to God. And I think Lois rightly said, living under the mercy and grace of Jesus Christ, our Savior, we leave those questions for God to answer and for him to deal with. And we always seek his forgiveness, not only for where we have, as our callers are saying, where we have tried to wrest control from God, which we can't do anyway. God is not, he does not have such a weak grip on our lives that we can wrest control from him. Even when we think we're controlling our lives, he's still in the driver's seat. But we seek the forgiveness of our Savior Jesus Christ for our motives too. For how many we had or didn't have. Now let's see what Norma has to say. She's calling from St. Louis. Norma, thank you for waiting.
Okay. I just wanted to play the devil's advocate a little bit. We all know that that contraception happens in a variety of ways, one of those being medication, a medication that stops ovulation or whatever, keeps it from happening. What are we going to do then when we think about other conditions that we need medication for? such as diabetes or arthritis or high blood pressure, are people going to say then, too, that we should not take medications for that as well? There are Parkinson's. There's lots of different things that people take medications for, and I just wanted to throw that into the mix because the definite purpose of the contraception medication is to keep a pregnancy from happening, and we use medications in our life to keep a lot of things from happening.
All right. Thank you very much, Norma. It's a good devil's advocate question. Let me see if I can respond to it. First of all, let's remember that ovulation and pregnancy are not disorders. I don't think we want to begin to regard ovulation and pregnancy as pancreas's, in the same way we would the pancreas's inability to regulate our insulin levels in our blood, where something's gone wrong, where the body is disordered. It's not ovulation and pregnancy are not a disorder that needs to be corrected chemically. So in that sense, I don't think we would call the pill medicine because it's not treating a disorder. Could it be preventative? People take medicines to prevent something from going wrong. Well, again, you're walking down the road of saying that ovulation or pregnancy is a disorder, something going wrong. So I just think philosophically we don't want to head down that path. In response to your devil's advocate question, we do medicate for all sorts of things, and we do it to correct, to treat, to cure, to prevent. But generally, when we're taking medicine, it's to deal with a disorder in the body rather than something that just happens of natural course in the body. A woman won't die if she ovulates, and a woman won't die if she has sex, and a woman won't die if she gets pregnant. Catherine's calling from Fenton. You've been very patient, Catherine. Thank you for waiting.
Thanks. I have three questions I'd like you to kind of consider, and they're kind of devil's advocate as well.
Sure.
And first, I'm glad that you said we shouldn't lose sleep over, you know, how many children we had or didn't have. I think that was an excellent point. But then you go back to contraception. Isn't any time you say, I'm not going to have sex at this time of the month because I could get pregnant and I don't want to get pregnant, that's control.
Yes, it whether, is.
Whether you use a pill or any other means of contraception.
Abstinence.
So there's no, yeah, there's no difference. So, but that said, then you get to adoption, which is wonderful. And I think about it myself. But then, rhetorically, are you still fulfilling the command? Because you aren't having another child that you could be having.
You're not multiplying technically. You're just
exactly.
It's a little more of a zero-sum game, if you
exactly.
want to think of it in those ways, yes.
Right. So it's, like I said, I'm speaking rhetorically.
Sure.
And then the third thing would be, we have three children. My husband did not want any more. So he made sure that that wasn't going to happen. I did want some more. But I went along with it. Now, then you get into the husband being the head of the wife, and then what do you do? When your husband doesn't want any more, and you maybe do. So there's my question.
Hey, Catherine, I was with you until the last one. On the last one, I'm not going to touch with a 10-foot pole. But, well, look, I'm going to speak very generally here because I don't know the particulars of the situation, but just because the husband is the head of the wife and the head of the family does not mean he doesn't make mistakes. If he decides to take the family in the minivan and take a trip to Mexico to buy drugs, he certainly is the head of the, he remains the head of the family, but he is misguided and misleading his family. Now, don't put too fine a point on that, Catherine. I'm not accusing your husband of that in any sense. I want to go back to your first point. First point is, if someone says, the Roman Catholic rhythm method, we're only going to have sex at this time because it reduces the chances that we're going to get pregnant, that is exercising control, isn't it? It gets down to those kind of nth degree questions. This is why we have to carefully think through the issue of contraception, not make bogus arguments that won't hold water if they're pushed to their nth degree. So we say, well, it's sinful then to avoid having sexual intercourse at all. Okay, then how many times a day? Every night? Why limit it to the hours of darkness? So their arguments, one way or the other, have to be solid enough that when pushed to the nth degree, they still hold water. For the remainder of this segment, we're going to be talking about Emperor Constantine. We're stepping back to the 4th century and thereabouts to what historians have called arguably one of the most influential statesmen ever when it comes to Christianity. Today, the church remembers Emperor Constantine. Dr. Thomas von Hagel is our guest. He's associate professor of theology at Concordia University, Chicago, and he's author of the book One Lord, One Faith, One Baptism, Christians Through the Centuries. Dr. von Hagel, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I guess the big question about Constantine that comes up all the time when people learn of his place in history is, was he really a Christian, as far as we can tell, or was Christianity a vehicle for his own aspirations and his empire's aspirations?
You're right. That's always the question we're always searching for. The wonderful story we have about, well, I guess a couple of things. You know, first, he's not baptized almost till his deathbed, and so that always is one issue that you're wondering, how could he be a Christian and not get baptized until the end of his life? And then, of course, the other, he is such a staunch supporter of Christianity through much of his career as emperor that how could he not be a Christian? So I don't know if you wanted a simple answer or... I mean, it's...
Well, if you were a betting man, do you expect to see Constantine in eternity?
It certainly seems to be that he was a Christian. I mean, I don't know how far you want to take the wonderful stories as after his father dies and his army in Europe, you know, declares him their leader, and he marches on Rome and defeats Maxentius. And just before that battle, he, at least according to Eusebius of Caesarea, a 4th century historian, said that Constantine and his army looked up into the sky, and in the sun they saw the sign of Christ. And then later that evening in bed when he was sleeping, Christ came to him in a dream and told him to use the symbol of Christ, the chi, rho, the two Greek letters for the first two letters of Christ. We see them in our churches. It looks like an X and a P superimposed. So if you take those stories, of course, then certainly for Christ to come to him and use that symbol of Christ and victory in this sign, then you can't hardly deny that he was a Christian. But throughout his career, he supported Christianity. At first, he simply tolerated Christianity and very much allowed both the pagan religions of the day and Christianity to coexist. His mother was a Christian and a very staunch Christian. She traveled to the Holy Land and seemed to, and just like all queen mums, you know, they always have a lot of influence, and so seemed to encourage him to bring revenues from the state into the church to build big churches in the Holy Land and, you know, back in the empire, in the other parts of the empire as well. So he seems very Christian, and calling the Council of Nicaea in 325 with the Council or the Creed, Nicene Creed, and whether Christ is fully God or partially God. And so he seems certainly more than interested in Christian things.
Does it's often said variously, and you've mentioned several, that he issued an edict in toleration of Christianity, along putting on even par with the other pagan religions of the Roman Empire, that he legalized it, or that he made it the official religion of his empire. Which of those is most accurate as to how Constantine eventually landed politically with Christianity?
It's really not until the 380s, you know, the end of the 4th century, that Christianity is officially the religion of the empire. In 313, thereabouts, there's the Edict of Milan that Constantine, the emperor of the western half of the empire, and Licinius, emperor of the eastern half, that they have the Edict of Milan that tolerates Christianity. And just sometimes it's overlooked, Galerius, a previous emperor who was a terrible persecutor of Christianity, in 311 finally realized that persecuting Christianity wasn't slowing it down. So in 311, there already had been an edict of toleration by Galerius to try to make martyrs out of the Christians and encourage them. So 313, yeah, the Edict of Milan really initially simply tolerates Christianity, but as I said, very clearly, it slowly moves from toleration to throwing tax revenues their way and being relatively supportive, but still short of being the official religion of the empire.
What I've always wondered is, and I've asked various guests this question whenever Constantine's role comes up, is it, taken on the whole and with the perspective of history, was it good for Christianity that it was eventually elevated through Constantine's activities, elevated to an official status in the Roman Empire?
Yeah, with the Council of Nicaea in 325, where you have Arius, who's suggesting Jesus is a demigod, and the Bishop of Alexandria, Alexander, that Jesus is full God, and then the fight begins, and so Constantine summons the bishops and their entourages to Nicaea, and many Christians often see, oh, this is really the beginning and flowering of Christianity, and there's some truth to it. As churches grow and the number of Christians, expands, and you have theologians that are able to write and, have their writings published and distributed throughout the empire. And at the same time, I also see it's, I hate to be overly pessimistic, but to some degree, it can be seen as almost the end of the church, that all of a sudden now you get that tangling of church and state together, that the church loves the tax revenues and the benefits of being the favored religious child in the empire, but then all of a sudden you have to compromise a bit if you want to keep that position. And so the church before Nicaea, the anti-Nicenes, it's anti with an E, not anti with an I, it's before the Council of Nicaea, that's one of the most, one of the ages of the church that has the most vitality as Christians are being persecuted and they're standing up and confessing their faith, and there are very few hypocrites in the church and no room for compromise. And so it's a bit of a two-edged sword. There's certainly benefits for Constantine and, not only tolerating the church but giving it nudges and encouraging it, but there's also weaknesses that, even today we see that in our church today. Our Christian church, we're opposed to abortion. Most of our most contemporary Christians are, but we speak against it. But we have to be careful we don't come across as fanatics, lest we lose all of our tax benefits and the other perks we get for being the favored religion. So,
Dr. Thomas von Hagel is our guest. Stay with us for a few minutes on the other side of the break, Dr. von Hagel.
Yes.
All right. Emperor Constantine is the subject for a few minutes on the other side of this break. Dr. von Hagel is Associate Professor of Theology at Concordia University, Chicago, and author of the book One Lord, One Faith, One Baptism, Christians Through the Centuries. And we're talking about Emperor Constantine. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The Christ-centered programs you appreciate every day on AM 850 KFUO are made possible in part by the generous giving of friends like Tom and Dot Ruby of Pacific, Missouri, Olene Saffel of Perryville, Jim and Marcia Scholl of Baldwin, and Norma Schroll of St. Louis. Your faithful support for AM 850 KFUO helps ensure the future of our radio ministry.
Camp Kangazoo at the St. Louis Zoo will double in size this year, offering two great camp themes, Battle of the Biomes and Ecology, Everything's Connected. Campers can now choose to attend one or both week-long camps throughout the summer. Kids in grades 1 through 6 can explore animal habits and habitats, play games, meet animals up close, have pizza, sleep under the stars, and wake up with the birds at Camp Kangazoo. Call the zoo for more information.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. You won't believe how far liberal sex educators are willing to go to convince your kids it's okay to have sex. At a mandatory assembly at Boulder High School in Colorado, students were told graphically to have sex and do drugs. Steve Jordahl has the story that will make your skin crawl.
Hi, my name is Joel Becker, and I'm a clinical psychologist.
You do not want your kids to meet Joel Becker. Some consider him a parent's worst nightmare. Here he's speaking to 14 to 18-year-olds.
I'm going to encourage you to have sex, and I'm going to encourage you to use drugs appropriately.
Becker is participating in a panel discussion sponsored by the University of Colorado at Boulder. He was one of four panelists at Boulder High.
I don't care if it's with men and men, women and women, men and women, however, whatever combination you would like to put together.
Briggs Gamblin speaks for Boulder Valley School District.
The one thing we did, we absolutely did err on, and it violated our own policy, was that we made this a required attendance for kids.
Was there no faculty from Boulder High or the district that was there that was saying during this, wait a minute, maybe I should go up and stop this. This really isn't appropriate?
Not that I'm aware of. Nobody has told me that.
Linda Klepacki of Focus on the Family Action has seen this coming for years.
This is exactly where Planned Parenthood has been pushing us since the early 1990s. People haven't believed it. I've heard it in conferences. Here it is. To think that our children now, this is the type of education, these are the messages that they're going to be given, and they are being given.
She says don't be surprised if your school is next. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
The students were told to enjoy whatever sex they feel emotionally ready for. Psychologists warn the adolescent brain is not ready to make that decision until the child is well out of high school. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
In this busy and technologically saturated world, it's hard sometimes to get your message through to people. Well, this is a reminder of the fastest, easiest way to lodge your opinion, ask your question, or offer a suggestion regarding our programming. At www.kfuo.org, you'll find a department labeled Contact in the upper left-hand corner. Click that and find the information you need to contact us either by phone or by email. And there are pictures, too, at kfuo.org.
Issues, Etc. Regular guest pastor John Pless is the author of our Book of the Month for May, titled Word, God Speaks to Us. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or you can read an excerpt of this Bible study on our website, issuesetc.org. What's the relationship between the Word of God and the work of the Holy Spirit? Find out with Word, God Speaks to Us, our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for May.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Folks, if you've ever had a question about Emperor Constantine, Council of Nicaea, the other significant events surrounding Emperor Constantine's life, our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Email us here in the studio for the next 10 minutes, issuesetc@kfuo.org, as we talk with Dr. Thomas von Hagel, Associate Professor of Theology at Concordia University, Chicago, author of the book One Lord, One Faith, One Baptism, Christians Through the Centuries. Dr. von Hagel, why did Constantine call the Council of Nicaea? What was his reason for doing this?
Well, there was this kerfuffle going on between Bishop Alexander and the priest Arius in Alexandria, and the, you know, rather significant, is Christ fully God or a demigod? And those are the kind of issues that not only will begin to divide a church, but also when you have an empire that's slowly becoming, or even quickly, filling with Christians, there's, you know, a concern that it could possibly divide the empire. And most leaders like unity, you know, economic, political, and religious unity of every type. And so he's certainly interested in the Christian faith. His mother's a Christian, and I say he's supporting it. And he no doubt, at the very least, seems to be concerned about a schism in the church from a political perspective as emperor. But even himself, he probably, I mean, the fact that he oversees the council himself and attends and speaks to it, he probably also had a personal interest in it as well.
Does this set a model, not just the council or the system of councils, but the fact that an emperor would call it, an emperor would technically preside for an unhealthy marriage between state and church in the future beyond Constantine?
Well, it's I guess if you have an emperor who's very orthodox and supportive of the church, you say, well, it's a fantastic example because, you know, then they work so well together. But then if you have a ruler who's, you know, less than orthodox or maybe even a bit heterodox, and then, of course, you say, oh, it's quite problematic. The whole idea, though, of an emperor calling a church council and being involved in the church will pop up in the 16th century when Luther is calling for a council to address theological issues in his day, and when Rome seems to ignore his call, he'll write a letter to the nobles of Germany and say, it's, you know, this is not unheard of. Constantine did it back in the 4th century, and look at the good results. And so Luther uses that argument in his day to try to get the German nobles and others possibly to kind of twist the arm of the Pope to call a council.
Tell us about Helena, Constantine's mother. You've mentioned her here a few times.
Yeah, his mother, of course, you know, was married to his father, but in Roman culture, not every marriage was the same kind of marriage. There were different types and levels of marriages, and she was, you know, kind of closer to a concubine than an actual wife, but nonetheless, she was his wife, kind of a humble background, but she survives her husband, and you know, some have suggested she was Christian from her youth. That's probably not the case, but say just a wonderful Christian woman. I'd mentioned earlier that I believe that she went to the Holy Land. Some suggest that this happens right after Constantine puts to death his oldest son. He had a son from a concubine himself, and there were rumors floating around that this oldest son Crispus was having sexual relations or committing adultery with Constantine's wife or the son's stepmother, and so the automatic judgment for that is death of his son. So he has his son put to death, and then the rumors are that she was involved voluntarily, so he has his wife put to death, and then Helena goes to the Promised Land, and some see it as maybe a bit of a pilgrimage, maybe to appease some of the citizenry of the Eastern Empire, but very important in encouraging Constantine to have you know, churches built in Bethlehem where Jesus was born, at the Holy Sepulchre, Mount, you know, where he ascends into heaven, and of course a few other places as well. And then, interestingly enough, for those that ever see pictures or icons, whenever you see Constantine, oftentimes there's a woman with him, and it's not his wife, but it's his mother, Helena.
And she is credited through that her visits to the Holy Land with perhaps being instrumental in securing the likely spots of a lot of these. You mentioned the churches being built, but inquiring as to where did this happen, where did that happen, and instigating in many ways kind of the preservation of these spots that people are still visiting today.
Correct. And of course, you know, one of the most exciting, if we don't certainly know if it's absolutely certain, but one of the more intriguing finds was the Holy Cross itself is often attributed to his mother. It's, I mean, most scholars nowadays would scoff a bit. Of course, most of those scholars would scoff that there ever was a Christ, maybe, or that he rose from the dead. But be that as it may, I mean, that's according to tradition. She supposedly got a hold of that thing. But yeah, very interesting lady, rather significant woman in the empire with her close relation to her son and being a staunch Christian and no doubt encouraging him along, almost like Augustine and his mother, Monica, almost a bit, having someone praying and a mother who's praying and pushing all the time.
Let's talk with Joe, who calls from his car. Joe, thanks for waiting. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
I have a question. Some people in the past have blamed the fall of the Roman Empire on the secular, or on Christianity, basically. My question for your guest is, if he thinks the secularization or the marriage of church and state back then had any effect on the fall of the Roman Empire, if so, could there be some possible similarities between the secular religion of America that we've had in the past and decline of American culture?
Thank you very much, Joe. Good question. Dr. Von Hagel.
Yeah, that's, that was certainly, even in Augustine's day, about a century later in the early 400s, where the pagans were claiming that as the barbarians from Europe are starting to move south and attack, that back in the good old days when the Roman Empire was ruled by the pagans, they never had those troubles, and now the Christians were in charge. It was, their fault. Augustine tries to do a good job of defending the Christian faith in the book, The City of God. That's really what it is. It's an attack on the Roman religions and the pagan religions of the day in a defense of the Christian faith. There may be some, our caller had a good question, and that's always, it's good to contemplate and to look at that effect on our own day. At the same time, when we look at states or nations, there does seem that they are cyclical. Whether there's a secularization of Christianity or any religion or even not, every nation is going to have its highs and lows, and they one after another fall sooner or later. So I'm always a bit leery with putting too much emphasis upon Christianity or the weakening of it or any other religion, but it's certainly not that they're not involved either. So try not to duck out the answer, but I don't know if you can place too much emphasis on it, but it may play a part.
Robert in Vermont asks this. He sends us an email. Was Constantine theologically engaged in the Nicene deliberations? Is there evidence to suggest that he cared about homoousius and so forth? Or was his biggest concern merely to try and stabilize the politics of the church?
Well, I mean, certainly both are there. He does actually address the council and seems to be involved a bit. I mean, he listens to some of the discussions, and he has Christian theologians who are his counselors, I mean, even before the council itself. Eusebius of Caesarea, Lactantius, Hosius. So it seems to be more than simply having a few court theologians. He was catechized, instructed in the Christian faith, and maybe he wasn't quite as involved as all of the rest of the theologians who were trained as such. But the fact that he addresses the council and is present and such seems that he had more than just a political interest in the outcome.
How do we account for his late baptism? You mentioned it early in our conversation.
Yeah, in part it could have been simply the politically correct thing to do, trying to rule an empire that has both Christians and non-Christians. And it's my understanding that as the emperor, he still had some kind of civil religious responsibilities that were attached with the Roman Empire that wouldn't be holy, W-H-O-L-L-Y, or completely Christian. But also, in the early church at that time, it was a somewhat common practice to be baptized later in life. The practice of absolving sins and granting forgiveness, little more rigorous expectation in those days. Oftentimes, Christians were granted, depending on kind of when and where they were at specifically, they were really only granted a few major absolutions for major sins or grievous sins. And so some would simply want to put off their baptism lest they might use up their absolutions too early and run short. So, and there were a few other reasons as well, but between being the emperor and maybe remaining a bit more objective religiously to the empire and then somewhat of a common practice in the day, both of those worked together to no doubt kind of push that off in his life.
With only 30 seconds, Eusebius is the major biographer and historian attached to Constantine. Is there any way of reading, and Eusebius, you say in your book, writes a very favorable account of Constantine. Is there any way of telling how Constantine was viewed by the church or by the empire in general, given his actions vis-a-vis Christianity? About 30 seconds.
Well, I mean, Eusebius is a church historian, and so, you know, his angle is a Christian angle. There are, of course, other historians of the day, both Christian and non-Christian, that give accounts. And, I mean, of course, the interesting thing is, just like when we is reading those today is just like reading the newspaper today. There are some newspapers that are a little more liberal and some that are a little more conservative, and so you always have to take that into account and understand the slant or perspective. And so, by and large, he would, seems to be much appreciated by most Christians across the board.
Dr. Thomas von Hagel is Associate Professor of Theology at Concordia University, Chicago, author of the book One Lord, One Faith, One Baptism, Christians Through the Centuries. This book is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, if you'd like to inquire, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. This book is excellent for, it's a nice primer. Now, when you talk about Christianity through the century, you got a lot of ground to cover, and this book does it very well in a concise way and acts as not only a great history lesson, but also a great perspective on Christianity throughout the centuries. You can also go to the website for Concordia Publishing House, www.cph.org, or 1-800-325-3040. Dr. von Hagel, thank you for being our guest.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, for the rest of this hour, we've got audio open lines for your questions and your comments. That leaves us just a little bit more than 10, 15 minutes. We said we were going to do audio open lines before, and we really didn't get to it. Let's do some now. Here's a Fox News story, and it's also a bit of a debate near the end of the package on American attitudes then and now on abortion.
The first plaintiff was Jane Roe.
The landmark case Roe v. Wade was argued twice, first in December 1971 and then again in October 1972.
In Texas, women still are not able to receive abortions from licensed doctors because doctors still fear that they will be prosecuted under the statute.
At the moment of conception, from the chromosomes, every potential that anybody in this room has is present.
In January 1973, the court issued its decision, with a majority voting 7-2 that restricting abortion violated the constitutional right to privacy. According to the Gallup poll, American attitudes toward abortion are remarkably stable, changing little since the landmark decision. In 1975, only 21% said they support abortion, no restrictions, with a majority 76% saying they are against it or should only be performed in limited cases. In 2006, the last time Gallup asked the same set of questions, supporters of abortion are still in the minority. As for the total number of abortions, even those statistics are subject to politics. According to the Guttmacher Institute based in New York City and Washington, D.C., the number of abortions in 1973, 744,000. Contrast that with figures from the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, 615,000. In the 80s and 90s, when abortion clinic protests were at their height, so was the number of abortions. The Guttmacher Institute says 1.6 million, the CDC 1.4 million. In early 2002, the figures range between 1.2 million and 850,000, the equivalent of a medium-sized city.
Joining us now with more on American attitudes about abortion and its impact on this political cycle is Dr. Charmaine Yost from the Family Research Council and Professor Pamela Bridgewater, a reproductive rights advocate.
All right, let's take a break here before they get into their debate, a debate of sorts, two different perspectives on the changing attitudes, or as the case may be, the unchanging attitudes of Americans regarding abortion since Roe v. Wade. I want to know what you have to say about this. It is interesting that the roughly the same number of people, percentage-wise, are opposed to abortion before Roe and after Roe. Even 34 years later, the numbers remain constant. What do you make of that? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's audio open lines. This Monday, May the 21st, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. One thing they'll discuss in this little debate, however, is that the number of abortions is significant. Or, I guess if you're in favor of abortion, apparently, if you listen carefully to the end of this debate, not so significant. Here's the debate from Fox News.
And lawyer from American University School of Law. Dr. Yost, I want to start with you. I think we've got some video, some sonogram video. What do we know today about what's happening in the womb and the fetus that we didn't know back in 1973?
Well, those sonograms are a great place to start, Catherine, because it really is amazing the advances that we've had in medical technology. Now you have these 4D sonograms. People are putting them up on YouTube, set to music, passing them around not only at the internet, but putting them on their refrigerator, giving their children names and introducing, saying this is the first picture of my baby. I think that has a dramatic impact on our culture and on people's attitudes. And long term, it's going to just chip away at people's acceptance. It's very hard for people to hold this at the same time in their mind, the idea that you can name this child, introduce them to people, and at the same time have the right to destroy that same life for any reason.
Professor Bridgewater, when you look at the statistics, what you see is that those who support abortion, no restrictions under all circumstances, it remains to be a minority of Americans. Why do you believe that's the case?
Well, the question asks whether abortion should be without restrictions, and that has always been a minority position. However, this recent poll shows that folks who are in favor of not criminalizing abortion are in the majority and have been since Roe, and that represents the pragmatism of American people, that they make these decisions based on the material conditions of their lives and their beliefs and their health, and American people want to preserve that.
So you're saying America?
I don't know how, that's not much of an answer. The question for the pro-choice advocate in this little debate from Fox News was, the people who, what does he make of the fact that the people who are in favor of abortion without restriction is a minority, has remained a minority, pretty much in the same area of percentages before Roe, after Roe, then, and now? And her response is, well, people just want to have the right to make that decision. Actually, a majority of Americans, we're talking about somewhere between 71 and 76% of Americans, believe that there ought to be some restrictions. So it's not an unqualified right that the majority of Americans are looking for here. Yeah, this is a good question. We've been talking recently a lot about Republican presidential candidate Rudolph Giuliani's position on abortion. Morally opposed, but in favor of a woman's right to choose. He's willing to call himself pro-choice. Good question for a debate for the candidate Giuliani might be, let's talk restrictions. The devil is always in the details.
American people want to preserve that.
So you're saying Americans make this decision based on what their personal choices are versus the fact that a life is involved?
Absolutely. Not a life is involved. There are many lives involved, but they certainly make these decisions less motivated by the political discourse, which is I think something that is new from this poll, that people make these decisions personally, and they're not motivated by the large mammoth political organizations or even Supreme Court cases.
Do you agree, Dr. Yost?
Well, I like the fact that she uses the word pragmatic, because what I would call it common sense, that what we try, you know, you see across the country trying to pass laws to require parental consent, spousal consent.
So I'm just going to jump in. You see a situation where people may not want Roe v. Wade overturned, but you see in the last couple of years at least this sort of chipping away at abortion.
Well, people don't understand what Roe v. Wade passed. When you explain to them that it made abortion legal throughout the entire pregnancy for any reason, people don't support that. That's not where the American people are. So then when you start bringing common sense into it and saying, you know, do you agree with this where, you know, parents have to be involved? Do you agree with letting women see a sonogram before they have an abortion? Things like this, people overwhelmingly support those kind of limitations and changes in the law. And yet the abortion movement in this country is so radicalized, they even supported the right to partial birth abortion, which the Supreme Court just overturned. So there's a very big disconnect between the policy advocates at the national level on the abortion side and where the American people are.
Professor Bridgewater, let's just talk about the numbers. Those numbers are pretty stunning. More than a million abortions in this country every year. I mean, that's a city. That's a big city.
Right, and it shows that people are going to make these decisions based on how they assess the needs of their lives. And what we should do, taking on a common sense approach, is to allow people to make these decisions, to support the decisions, as opposed to make it more difficult for them. The idea that this divisive language the rhetoric of the discourse is just not playing out in the numbers. People are motivated by their life's experiences. And the numbers have gone down over time, which means that as we talk to young girls, protect young girls, as we open schools in South Africa for young girls, we teach them to take care of themselves. And so this option, they won't have to choose it.
That's very interesting to hear, isn't it? I think one thing has changed in the adamant pro-choice forces in 30 years since Roe. One thing. You know what it is? It's now being, more often than not, while it still is asserted as a constitutional right, a woman's inalienable right to choose. Did you hear what she said? An option that women shouldn't have to choose. That you would not have found the major proponents of abortion saying 30 years ago. I think they thought that Roe would bring a majority of Americans around to their position, which is abortion on demand all 9 months for any reason, with no restrictions whatsoever. But it hasn't. So where has the change come? Not in those who are opposed to unrestricted abortion. That remains solid as a majority. Those who are in favor of unrestricted abortion are now beginning to talk as though it might not be such a good idea. A choice, maybe a necessary choice, but not one that they would really want a woman to have to make. That's a change. At Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, they're preparing future pastors to defend life from beginning to end, from the clear and unequivocal Word of God. It's just one of the things they're training their pastors to do, to bring the gospel to bear upon all kinds of sins, including those that have to do with the issues of life. The forgiveness of sins of Christ is for all sins and all sinners. That's what they're doing at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. You can find out more about it by going to our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find their logo there. You can also call them toll-free, 1-888-481-2155. 1-888-481-2155. When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking about best-selling book, DVD, The Secret. Professor David Lewis of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis will be our guest.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.